Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 17th of December. This hour, Helen Ann Halpin, professor of health policy and director of the Center for Health and Public Policy Studies at the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health. Professor Halpin has been a guest of ours many times during the past many months as we've been looking at health care reform. Now we're down to, well, what are we down to? That's the question of this hour. The public option is no longer on the table. The Medicare buy-in is no longer on the table. So what kind of health care reform bill do we have? And is it, will it do anything good for the American people? Is it a real boom to the insurance industry? We're going to have tons of phone calls for Professor Halpin. And of all the people that we have talked to, and they have been many during the past few months, she really has done her homework and has a very deep understanding of every bill that has made its way to the House, to the Senate, the committees that have made their way, their bills to the floor, and, well, more simply put, she knows what she's talking about. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation. Professor Helen Ann Halpin, very nice to have you with us today. Hi.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
So we don't have a public option. We don't have a Medicare buy-in. Some are saying that this is really a bill for the insurance companies. They're going to reap tremendous profits, not that they already don't, but even more from this. Are you discouraged, or do you see something good here?
Well, like everyone, I'm discouraged. You know, we thought in the summer in August that the public option was dead, and then it came back to life when Harry Reid introduced his version of the Senate bill, and it's gone again. And basically, I think what we're back to is the version of the Senate bill that Baucus introduced out of the Finance Committee. Mm. That didn't have any of those features. It was, you know, exchanges in the states offering a choice of private plans with a mandate, with subsidies up to 400% of poverty, with Medicaid for everyone under 133% of poverty. So, I mean, the bill that as it exists now looks very much like that Baucus bill, which the president praised, and I think many people are suggesting that this is, in fact, the bill that the president wants, and that if he didn't want it, he'd be doing something actively to get what he wanted. And I think the writing actually, you know, now that I've been reflecting back and looking back over the last 6 months or so to try to understand where we've been and what's happened. And I've been reading lots of analysis, and the only explanation that makes really any sense to me is that early on, the White House decided that it did want to cut deals with the industry, and we all know about the quote-unquote secret deal they cut with the pharmaceutical companies so there wouldn't be any negotiation on pharmaceutical prices, no reimportation of drugs, et cetera. And they've also cut similar deals with the hospitals, with the AMA and the doctors, and with the insurance companies themselves. And I think, from what I understand, it was sort of, this is all a political strategy. It has nothing to do with ideology. I think that the president sincerely likes the idea of the public option, but I think they wanted to keep these huge stakeholders, they wanted to keep them from advertising against the White House plan. They wanted to keep them at the table on their side, because we've all seen what they could do in the past. They can kill a bill if they want to, and they played nice. They've spent tens of millions of dollars in ads and supporting Democratic freshmen and the Blue Dogs. Second, I think they wanted to keep them from torpedoing the Democrats in 2010, because in 1994, after health care reform failed under Clinton, all the money from these industries went to support Republicans to take over the White House, and the White House certainly didn't want that to happen again. So this would keep them, this would keep the industry money in the Democrats' hands and keep it out of the GOP coffers. Mm. And if you look at it strategically from that perspective, they've been very successful. I mean, this bill will help probably get coverage to close to 30 million people, which is substantial. And what I keep trying to remind people is let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, it would be possible to put the public option into a reconciliation bill, but you can't put the preventive and wellness care, you can't put the community health center expansions, you can't put the regulation of the insurance industry in a reconciliation bill. What I would like to see happen, and I think will maybe temper the fury of the progressives right now, because Obama, it feels like he's really losing his base.
Yes,
there's so much anger about this public option, which has apparently been a pawn in a game that none of us understood was being played. We all, you know, put our hopes on it and thought this, you know, that this was a possibility, that yes, we can, right? But I don't think it ever was. I think it was something that he could mention occasionally to keep the stakeholders at the table because he knew they didn't want it, and yet trade off at the last minute to get a bill that the stakeholders can live with, but that would also be relatively good, not as good as what we wanted, but relatively good for the American people. My concern now is affordability. And if they mandate that people buy private insurance, I am concerned that many, many people will not only not be able to afford that insurance, but that they're going to have to pay a fine and still be uninsured. And that just seems wrong. And Obama did campaign hard against the individual mandate. And I think that if they would strip that mandate out of this bill until there is a public option, that might help. Now, whether that can happen or not, I have no idea. But it seems to me that's the only thing, listening to the progressives over the last few days, that might appease them, because they don't want to be forced to buy for-profit health insurance.
Right. So underlying, even though there may be some good aspects of this, what I'm hearing you saying is that winning is what was all important here, and not health care. Making the stakeholders of pharmaceutical and insurance companies happy really got us in the pickle that we're in right now.
Well, except that, I mean, it does do a lot of good. It'll double the size of the Medicaid program. That helps about 15 million people immediately get insurance, and the feds will pick up most of the tab. Anybody who earns under 400% of the poverty level, which is if you earn less than $88,000 for a family of four, your premiums will be subsidized by the government if you buy in the exchange. And that's valuable. That will help those people afford coverage. But the problem is, from my perspective, also in the last few days, they've taken they've said that the industry can use caps on annually what they'll pay out, which means that people will still be able to go bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's unacceptable. They can vary the premium up to 300% based on your age, so that people who are 55 to 64 will be paying very high premiums. And they've also allowing them to charge you more for your premiums, up to 50% more, if you have what they call a risk factor. So if you have high blood pressure or high cholesterol or smoke, and if you're 55 to 64, chances are you have high blood pressure or high cholesterol, so that your prices are going to be even higher. And so it's this chipping away at the affordability, from my perspective, that's the most troubling, because if you make sure that the product's a decent one, and you control the industry so that it can't deny people coverage or drop them, and the bill still has those safeguards in it, I think we've gone a long way. We certainly haven't gone as far as we want, but I do agree that it's crazy to kill this thing. I think they should tweak it to try to get it to a level that's acceptable, and then maybe use reconciliation for the public option. I mean, that's the only way out that I see. I think if they kill it now, we won't get anything, and that's worse.
Right. What was the significance? A couple things here. I want to talk about Obama and whether or not that's interesting what you said, that this is what he had in mind all along. We could have had, or am I reading this wrong, something different if it had not been for Senator Lieberman. They would have had 60 votes,
well,
right?
I mean, yesterday or Sunday or whenever it was, Lieberman indicated that the White House had actually thanked him for pulling.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
And so, I mean, that's consistent with this idea. They're not blasting Lieberman. They're blasting Howard Dean.
Right, exactly.
So, I mean, one has to try to find a story that makes sense out of these things. And from my perspective right now, I think this is the bill the White House wanted. When Baucus's bill came out, the White House was pleased as punch and said this was a great bill. And progressives went crazy and started really pushing for the public option. I think they got as many as 60 congressional representatives to sign on saying they wouldn't vote for a bill if it didn't have one. And that pressure was on Harry Reid also to include one in the bill that he introduced. But Lieberman was never going to support it. And we've got other problems besides Lieberman. I mean, we've got Ben Nelson, who still says yes. He won't support it without tougher abortion restrictions. And then there's, you know, Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins, who maybe, you know, we can pull them away from the Republicans and we wouldn't need Lieberman. But the problem is the clock is clicking down. And yesterday they spent, 3 hours reading Bernie Sanders' single-payer amendment,
right.
Word for word. What a waste of time. And he finally pulled the amendment. But the Republicans will help to do anything to slow this process down. And maybe it can wait till the new year. But if it's not done by the State of the Union, I just don't see how it gets done.
How can the president afford to lose his progressive base? Helen?
I don't know. As far as his reelection, my guess is what they're banking on is that the economy will be better. And in presidential elections, it's always about the economy, stupid.
Mm-hmm.
So if the economy does rebound, if people are back to work, regardless of what happens here, I think that it's possible for him to bring them back. Although, I don't know. I will tell you, emails I have been getting from progressive friends, they are so angry. They feel like they're disheartened, they're discouraged, and they're disappointed, and they've really lost faith. They really believe that, and I believe, too, that if President Obama really wanted a public option, we would have one. And that's my disappointment. And he campaigned hard against mandates, and we're going to have mandates. So there's a disconnect between what he said on the campaign trail and what he's saying now. And I understand that one is just promises, and now he's living with the political reality of Washington. And as much as he wants to change it, one man can't change it. And he's got this guy, Rahm Emanuel, who understands Congress better than anyone. I mean, I think if the White House wanted something bad, oddly enough, between the president and Rahm, they can make it happen. But Rahm, it's been clear since practically since the beginning that Rahm did not want the public option, that the Blue Dogs would not support it, and why we all believed that somehow we could overcome that. You know, I look back now and think, was I naive? Was I just hopeful? Because it seems like the writing has been on the wall for a really long time, and the president's statements in support of the public option have been very weak.
Mm-hmm. Well, nobody knew exactly where he was on this, and so
right.
it was really interesting to watch all of this, because people thought, I think, a month ago or even 3 weeks ago, that there was going to be some kind of public option. Everybody was happy about it. Yeah. And it didn't happen. The other thing about these drug prices, it's my understanding, Professor Halpin, that the pharmaceutical companies have already upped their prices fairly significantly, thinking there's going to be something that wouldn't be good for them. But this thing about not, and he campaigned, and they were playing the clips last night, Obama campaigning on, you know, we don't, why are we paying twice as much for drugs as Canada or
right.
friends in Europe? This shouldn't happen. He was so clear about that. And evidently, they must have one heck of a lot of power, because that seems almost like a given if you're going to have health care reform.
It is. And, I mean, even if you cut them in half, you'd reduce drug price, you'd reduce total health care costs by about 5%. What people don't realize is drug costs only represent about 10% of the total bill. So even cutting them in half doesn't give you enormous savings. It's significant. It's important. And actually, you know, the cost for drugs in Europe, if you're uninsured, is less than most people's co-payments in the U.S. I mean, it's really that extreme. These companies are just making huge profits, but they're also politically very powerful.
Right.
And I think the White House decided to play ball with them and still try to craft a bill that would be would fix a lot of the problems, certainly not all of the problems, but a lot of the problems in the healthcare system. So I think there, I mean, I would like them to, I would like to see them keep the good things in the bill, but find another way to get the public option, because honestly, it's going to be very interesting when the Congressional Budget Office comes out with its scoring. They're going to have to tweak it because the bill they're scoring has the Medicare buy-in, and it has the national nonprofit plans. And my understanding is that both those are now stripped out.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no competition for the private insurance industry. So I don't see how it can be anything but, you know, busting through through the deficit, not deficit reduction. And if it doesn't come out as deficit reduction, then I don't think it's going to be able to find anywhere near 60
votes.
Well,
Senator Landrieu was saying last night that there would be, she was having this huge fight with Howard Dean.
I know, I saw that.
You saw that too. But she mentioned something, and they never had time to explore this more fully, that there would be a national nonprofit plan.
Well, I was very confused about that because on Sunday, Lieberman came out against both the Medicare buy-in and the national nonprofit private insurance plans. And so I don't know if it's in there now or not. I'm very confused.
Oh, I'm confused. And if you're confused, believe you me, we are all confused because you're not confused.
Well, we haven't seen anything in writing.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's
go. Normally, I read the bill before I come on the air with you.
I know you do. I know it's amazing. You read the whole bill. You stayed up all night the last time we talked. Let's go to phone calls. We have tons of them. Even before we said we're on the air, we had phone calls. I knew many of you would want to talk about this. So we'll be with you in a moment. Keep the number in mind if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is our number. Do you have a good understanding of what's happening with health care reform? And what do you think of it? This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, starting with David from San Francisco. Hi, David.
Hey, morning, Kathleen and Professor. And by the way, is a professor over in Oakland right now or Berkeley?
No, I'm not, actually.
This is a local call, I'll bet.
Well, yes.
I wanted to raise a couple of different economic questions regarding medical care. And the first one comes from Hippocrates. And if I remember right, the very first version of the Hippocratic Oath had it very plain that doctors were supposed to heal you first and then deal with money later. Heal first, money later. And so the whole idea that we are locking ourselves with this legislation, hypothetically, the Hippocratic Oath has stood the test of time, and America is not caught up in a trap where they have to pay first, and then maybe they'll heal you later. So that's...
Unfortunately, that's the way it's been for quite a while. If you don't have insurance, many, many doctors and even hospitals, unless it's an emergency, will not see you for care. So, and the other thing that you should probably be aware of is, in fact, most medical school graduates don't say the Hippocratic Oath anymore. The Hippocratic Oath includes a phrase that would prohibit abortion, and so anyone who's pro-choice doesn't want to say the Hippocratic Oath. So actually, there are many other different oaths that medical students say, but I think your point is well taken. First, do no harm, and let's heal before we worry about the money. But unfortunately, since our system transitions so effectively and so quickly from a non-profit system to a for-profit system, money has been driving everything, and since our elected officials are dependent on this money for getting reelected, the money is there, it's front, it's center, and you know, we learned in Watergate, follow the money, right? We need to look at where the money's coming from and where it's going right now, and there's no question that the industry is calling the shots.
Thank you, David. Mike from Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm not confused. What we have, if we have a bait-and-switch con man politician, Southside politician of Chicago, that's our president. And it's time that all of us realize this. And Rahm Emanuel is a master manipulator. This is not health care reform. This is a welfare bill for the medical-industrial complex. Face it. That's what we're dealing with, folks. And you better face it. I had the privilege of hearing Ralph Nader speak in Milwaukee 2 months ago, and Ralph Nader said, unequivocally, we will not get a public option.
Professor Halpin.
Well, I mean, I think in many ways he's right. I think it was a bait and switch. I think it was used for two purposes. One, to keep the public supportive of the bill, and two, as a threat to the industry that if they didn't, you know, if they didn't continue to be supportive and play along and stay at the table and not help the Republicans, that we could always put in a public option, which they wouldn't want. So I think it was used for two purposes. We're at the end game here. I don't know what yard line we're on in the football metaphor, but maybe it's the fifth. I don't know. There's three downs, and we don't have much time left, and so they pulled it. And I don't think it's going to go back in. I think this caller's right. But I do still think there are many, many things that are good in this bill, and I do think there is another route to still getting a public option through reconciliation. So I think that's what we should be fighting for. That's what we should be pushing for. We don't want to give up this opportunity. There's 30 million people who will benefit from this bill, will be able to buy insurance who previously could not. And that is important. And there are also many other things in there, all the prevention stuff, the community health center stuff, the exchanges, all the regulations on the insurance companies. So I think, let's take what's good in this and continue to fight for what's not there.
I want to talk more about the uninsured. Numbers vary, 40 million, 45, maybe even above that number of people in this country who are uninsured. I'm a little confused, Professor Halpin, about how all of those people will be covered at a rate that is affordable for them.
Well, that's what there's like $458 billion in subsidies for folks whose incomes are below 400% of the poverty line. I think something like, I'm not sure exactly what the number is, but it's at least 80% of the uninsured had incomes at 300% of the poverty line or below.
Okay.
So these subsidies would be available to the vast majority of people who are now uninsured. In addition, the 15 million new people who will be eligible for Medicaid, you don't have to pay any premium. And depending upon what state you live, there may be cost sharing, but it's very nominal. It's like $5, $10. So for the vast majority of the uninsured, they'll either be getting Medicaid, which is completely subsidized, or a private plan that is partially subsidized based on their income.
Okay.
So it will help them.
So it will cover almost everybody, are you saying?
Well, their estimates are 31 million is the estimate that I've seen out of the 46. Now, we know, I don't know how many of that 46 are undocumented residents, and so they're not eligible to participate under this piece of legislation.
So
they're automatically not covered. And then you've got this huge group of people who we really don't know. We haven't found good solutions. San Francisco actually is a pretty decent one, but who are homeless, who are drug addicts, who are alcoholics, who are, I don't know. They're people who live on the margins, in the shadows, and aren't going to, don't have jobs and don't get counted even in a census, who probably would never participate in some sort of organized system like this. And so you've got them. I don't know how many they represent, but I would say it's probably going to cover 95% of, legal American residents who currently don't have coverage.
Okay. Let's go. Thanks, Mike, for your call. Jess is next from Two Harbors. Hi, Jess.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
My question is, a couple months ago I'd heard quite a bit of talk about let's just get a bill and then we can take it from there. And I'm wondering how radically this bill could be changed after the fact. I guess much of our the great legislation of
yeah.
the past.
It's always very difficult. I mean, if you look at the idea of Medicare originally was to give it to the elderly and then eventually expand it to the rest of the population. And as we can see, you know, after, oh, Lord, how many years is that? That was 64. We haven't been able to expand it at all. It's very, very difficult. I think you can, you could use budget reconciliation for either expanding Medicare or even adding a public option after the fact. The dilemma is that there are senators who are just philosophically opposed to using that route. That's not what it was intended for, and they won't support going in that direction. So you can tweak it. You can do little tweaks, but to do anything major with significant budget implications would be difficult, I believe.
Thank you, Jess, for your call. Jim from Milwaukee, hi.
Yes. Well, it just obviously it seems to me we've been sold out, and the first thing that I want to concentrate on is finding ways to bypass the corporate wing of the Democratic Party and find new ways to fund and to nominate and elect progressive Democrats, because otherwise we're not going to get anything done. The filibuster process, it seems to me, is counter to democracy. It allows people to obstruct and not get anything done and to thwart change, and so it has to be overridden in some fashion. And reconciliation, it seems to me, is the process to go. And the thing that I'd point out there is that, you know, if we're really interested in democracy, if we're really interested in majority rule, then, and since the Senate does have a right to set its own rules, you know, what's wrong with implementing reconciliation on a larger, and use that as a lever in a larger way to implement larger issues to be passed? You know, the question that comes to mind is the Senate really interested in democracy?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what you've said, and I'm encouraging my representatives to go the route of reconciliation. I would love to see the Senate change the filibuster rules. I mean, this is just ridiculous. They're literally stopping the work of the government with these filibuster threats. I'd actually like to see them do a filibuster, call their bluff, put Joe Lieberman on TV 24/7 talking about God knows what, and see how the American people like that. I mean, I feel like the Democrats cower at the threat. Let them try it and see what the reaction is. I think the public would overwhelmingly urge to shut it down and let the work of the Congress proceed. Mm. I think you're right. I think our democracy really is at risk. We're electing people who are getting elected with corporate money. We've got to change the finance rules. I mean, if we don't have publicly financed campaigns, I really worry about the future of our country, honestly, because we can't do the people's work. We're doing the corporation's work.
I thought Howard Dean made an interesting point. He made a lot of interesting points yesterday, but one was the Democrats don't seem to be tough enough. If they've got a majority, they've got a Democratic president, and maybe he's somebody other than we thought he was. Progressives at least thought that way and wanted something that progressives, quite opposite than what progressives wanted. But, you know, if you're not going to get it now, when the heck are you going to get it? Some kind of significant health care.
That's what I'm saying. Right. I think the only logical conclusion, given the White House's praise for the Baucus bill and now for this bill, they're happy with this bill.
Yeah, interesting.
that they didn't want the public option. Obama's been intimating at that all along. He said it wasn't central, and, you know, he supported it, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't going to be the be-all or the end-all for reform. He's been signaling this for 6 months, and so has Rahm. Rahm wanted the trigger. You know, they tried to float this co-op idea, and I think the other caller was right. It has been bait and switch to a large degree, and it's very upsetting, I think, for those of us who worked so hard. But I think we can't lose sight of the fact that still, even without that, there are really, really important things in this bill that we do want. And to throw the baby out with the bathwater, I think, would be a huge mistake. So I don't agree kill the bill. I mean, I say let's make this bill as powerful as possible. Let's take all the gains that we can. There's lots of gains here, but let's not give up the fight for the public option and find another method. If it's not reconciliation, I'm not sure how else we can go. But because I do think it's critical for controlling costs and for giving people an option other than a for-profit insurance company.
But if you don't have a president who believes in that as well, how likely are you to get that, Helen?
Well, I don't know, especially if you think that the future of your party's reelection is in the hands of those corporate interests. You're not going to want to make them angry. But it is hard to imagine that the Senate wouldn't, I mean, that the president wouldn't sign a budget reconciliation bill with a public option in it. But I think it will come down to a political calculation, and I don't know what that calculation would be.
Right. Thanks, Jim, for the call. Steve from Oshkosh. Hi.
Good morning. Professor, may I ask you, wouldn't it be enormously helpful for our effort to get down to a mastery of the language and truth in labeling? For example, I refer to the American healthcare industry as organized crime healthcare. It seems to me that Joe Lieberman, rather than being a senator, is a prostitute. And I don't say that flippantly or casually, but if you get down to the analysis, it seems to me the health insurance industry has a gun to our heads and says, pay a lot of money and we may or may not protect you.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't use that language. I know Keith Olbermann used that language in reference to Senator Lieberman last night. I mean, what you need to understand is that the health insurance industry is a big part of Senator Lieberman's constituency. Aetna is based in Hartford. Hartford, Connecticut is the insurance capital of the world. And that's who he represents. And so it shouldn't come as a surprise to us. I just call him Joe Aetna Lieberman. But you're right. I don't think using that kind of inflammatory language contributes to the debate, so I choose not to do that. But I understand your point, and I agree with you.
Thank you, Steve. We go next to Scott from La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen.
Thanks. Hi, Scott.
Again. My question, Helen, has to do with the House of Representatives. I mean, we seem like we're just fixated on all these egomaniacs that we call U.S. senators in this country. And I guess what it occurs to me is if I were over there in the House watching all this, knowing that reconciliation is coming up, and watching the Senate just willy-nilly strip this and that out of the bill, how on earth will some of those folks who seem to be pretty have a pretty good backbone to stand up for some things they really wanted to get through? How are they going to swallow hard and accept a bill that is so different from what they passed?
Yeah. Well, I think Rahm actually knows how to get what he wants out of the House of Representatives, and my understanding of what is most likely to happen, there isn't enough time to go to reconciliation and try to reconcile the House bill with the Senate bill, and it would likely be more liberal than the current Senate bill, so if it came back to the Senate with any of these things they'd stripped out, the Senate wouldn't pass it, and it would be dead. My understanding is the only way through at this point is for Senator Reid to send the Senate bill directly to the House and require them to have an up or down vote on it, and that way you avoid the reconciliation process. So it's the Senate bill or nothing. My guess is that the House would probably support it. They'd only need a majority. And then it could go directly to the president's desk. It wouldn't have to go through any more committees. It wouldn't have to go through any more votes in either chamber. That is the most expeditious route, and I think the most likely route. If and when the Senate can get 60 votes to vote on this thing and it passes it, my guess is this is the bill that goes to the House. I think basically what's happening is the House is being cut out of the process, and that from the Senate's perspective, their bill is just too liberal to pass, and we won't see that bill or what's in it again. That's my guess.
But didn't it just barely get through the House?
Couple votes. Their bill.
The House bill?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, initially.
Which, it was
sure
close, but it passed. I mean, they have the votes,
for.
And I think there seems to be more discipline in the House in terms of the Democratic Party. It's hard to imagine, and maybe they would, that the House would actually not pass the Senate bill. it's a possibility, but it's hard for me to imagine that if the president wants that bill and Rahm Emanuel's working the House, that they won't pass it, because they can always, they have power. They can threaten not to support people in the next election cycle who don't vote for it. So, I mean, they have a tremendous amount of leverage over the outcome of this, should they choose to exercise it.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for the call. All right, help me understand this. The government, we're all going to have to get insurance. So
right.
It'll be private plans. And
there'll be an exchange in every state.
An exchange in every state. What is in this plan to hold down the cost of what the insurance company is charging you? Is there anything?
Well, one of one of the things is, and I, again, I don't know if it's still in there, is that the health insurance companies would be required to spend 90 cents out of every dollar on direct health care, which would mean they could only spend 10% on administrative costs and profits. So right now they're spending at least 15, if not 20, if not 25, depending upon who you talk to. So it would require them to squeeze their administrative costs and potentially even squeeze their profits. So that's hard to imagine. My guess is they would try to become more efficient. They won't have as big a job to do with marketing and advertising, because everyone will be, it's one-stop shopping. It's like going, what would be the similar example? Going to a restaurant and choosing what you want for dinner off a menu. Unfortunately, I think in a lot of states, people won't have very many choices. Without these national nonprofit plans, which we don't know if they're still there or not, there won't be much choice. And we also don't know whether, if they are still there, the industry will step up to create them. I mean, why would it be in Aetna's interest to create a nonprofit plan
right.
to compete with its for-profit plan?
Of course.
Doesn't really make any sense. But
no.
But anyway, that's what it is. So no, I don't know what would be left to hold down costs.
Which is one of the reasons we need health care reform, isn't it?
Yes,
to hold down costs.
Yeah.
All right, Scott, thanks very much for your call. Let us go next to Mike from Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, how and why did the insurance companies become exempt from the antitrust laws? To me, this seems like the crux of the situation. A public option is the government competing against the insurance companies. Why not remove the antitrust and let the insurance companies compete with each other?
Well, and there was discussion of removing the antitrust. I don't know if that's still in there or not. My guess is it's not. But I know there was a tremendous amount of support among many Democrats for stripping the industry of that exemption. But again, honestly, I don't know what the fate of that is at this point. But if the rumors that the industry has won are true, then it's probably not there. And I think that's a mistake. I mean, the other question is whether they're going to be able to sell across state lines. And this has huge implications for the products that will be offered, because states right now have responsibility for regulating health insurance. And what will happen if they can sell plans nationally is they can go to the state that has the least regulations, the least protections, the least benefits mandated, and sell it out of that state and not have to meet any of the regulatory requirements of other states. So that's a bad deal also, and I have heard that the Republicans wanted that, the Blue Dogs wanted that, the industry obviously wanted that, and it may be a race to the bottom in terms of what's being offered in these exchanges, so I'm very concerned.
Professor Helen Halpin is our guest. She's professor of health policy and director of the Center for Health and Public Policy Studies at the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health. We're talking about the public option out, Medicare buy-in out, what's being called by progressives in this country as a real, more money to the insurance companies. What do you think of what you're hearing? What about the president? Was he lax in terms of telling people what he wanted? Is this the bill that he really did want? What about Joe Lieberman? What about the whole process? And what does it mean? What kind of health care reform would there be? We're talking with Helen about all of this and welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Thursday, we'll be talking about the latest research on breast cancer and the screening guidelines. So that's coming up, hour number two. Back to your phone calls. Ron is next from Blooming Grove. Hi, Ron.
Thanks. Step one, adjust Medicare age by 66 years, not 10 years. Step two, merge the solid gold medical program that covers federal politicians, Congress, cabinet members, judges, and all of their spouses and children. Merge that with the expanded Medicare system. Then all the other problems will be solved by those politicians. Now back to your bigger question, understanding how Congress works. It has never been a democracy. It is plutocracy. But the members are not owned by big money directly like you would own a car or a cabin. Congress members are like luxury resort timeshare condominiums. Different sections of the big money interests own a fraction of each congressperson. Perhaps 300 members are owned by the pharmaceutical industry, but they only need them for 2 or 3 weeks out of the 52-week year. Other weeks are owned by other groups. You know, there are pro-choice groups, there are pro-life groups, there's the NRA, there are gun control groups. They all own a certain number of weeks of certain Congress members, and whichever one comes up with a majority wins on that particular type of issue. I think Will Rogers deserves the credit for this quote. We have the best Congress money can buy. Maybe you can confirm Will Rogers originated that idea.
It's hard for me to understand. We have the best Congress money could buy. I don't think money should be buying our Congress. So I think that if money's buying it, it's not representing the will of the people, and the Congress is supposed to be doing the work of the people. So I guess I fundamentally disagree, but until and when we have campaign finance, this is the system that we have, and it's discouraging. You know, it's never pretty watching a legislation been made, and I'm not aware of another piece of legislation that the public as a whole has followed as intensely, but
yes.
Believe me, it's never pretty.
No, it's not pretty. What about the public as a whole? We haven't talked about them very much. I can recall doing programs with you, actually, not that long ago when there was overwhelming public support, way over 50% for some kind of public option here. Polls yesterday from NBC Wall Street indicating that the public support for health care reform, as it's being talked about now, is just dwindling.
Yeah.
What's going on with that? What do we think?
Well, I mean, I think no matter what side you listen to right now, it's getting negative press. The progressives are screaming that they don't like the bill. The Republicans have been consistent in wanting to kill the bill. It's hard to think of who the voices are, particularly in the meeting, in the media, saying, this is a good bill. This has good things in it. We need to support it. And Senator Rockefeller, I think, came out and was trying to make that argument that there's still some good things in this bill. Senator Landrieu yesterday seemed to be arguing that there were good things in this bill. But I think most of the voices are negative. And when you've got both voices on both sides of the debate saying something is not good, public support will fall like a rock.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly has. And such a change from not that long ago, Professor Halpin.
Things can change very quickly.
I guess.
I mean, and we all knew this. I mean, there's a window that opens in politics in a situation like we had in this last election when you have a newly elected Democratic president and a majorities in both houses of Congress. Most people say it's a 90-day window, that if President Obama was really serious about getting health care reform, he should have been working with the Congress to get a bill introduced in those first 90 days. And with each passing month, you lose political capital, and you lose the ability to control the debate and control the bill. And if that window hasn't closed. It's about to close. And the bill, you know, as it goes on, and we've watched this happen, it gets weaker and weaker and weaker. And at some point, there's a point where people will say, I can't live with this. And I think many progressives are at that point. But I think the American people, the 40 or 50 million who don't have insurance, are desperate for a solution. If we don't pass this bill, I don't know when we revisit this again.
Not for a long time.
I mean, we can't just abandon those people.
Thanks, Ron, for your call. Clyde from Grafton. Hi.
Hi, Joy. Thank you again.
It's Kathleen.
Excellent, excellent series over the last several months on the healthcare crisis. The calls from your from callers have shown that that a lot of people have learned an awful lot, and probably much of it has been from your series. Thanks to your guest, I agree with basically the premises, almost all the premises that your guest has presented, and with one exception, and that is I've never been enthralled with the words with the public option. That always seemed clearly to me to be a distraction from the real solution that we need for the problems presented by the healthcare crisis, which is simply strengthening and expanding Medicare to cover everyone. And then the reason, of course, that we don't have that, as many people have been stating lately, is clearly that we don't have government by and for the people. It's government by and for the corporations and the lobbyists. There are several reforms that we need to get over that, and I'm going to propose one, and that would be somewhat of a reform of our current Congress. We should retain two houses, but the Senate right now is constituted such that 12% of the people can elect enough senators to block any legislation. Instead of a Senate, we need to have a House of Women and a House of Men. Yeah, wait, please. And both houses should be representative. Should be elected on the basis of one person, one vote, and they should be representative of the equal representation. One House of Men and one House of Women, instead of the current House of Representatives and the Senate.
Professor
That's a
Halpin.
Very interesting proposal.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Well, those senators are kind of elitist, aren't they? I mean, it is. Maybe it needs to be.
They're all millionaires.
I know they are. Maybe it needs to be revised somehow. Let's get rid of that Senate as it is. All right. Thank you very much for your call, Clyde. I don't mean to laugh at it. It's a worthy proposal. I don't know how far you'll get with it, but it's
And I
worthy.
Thoroughly support the idea that there need to be more women
yes.
In elected office, particularly at the national level. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thanks, Clyde, very much. Send along your proposal. We'll, in more detail, you can send me an email, and I'll bring it up in a future show. Scott from Oshkosh, hi.
Good morning. It would have been nice if the debate would have been we need universal coverage with a private option as opposed to a public option. I mean, we should be able to cover everybody, and then also have, if you don't want to be in it, you should have the private option as opposed to, I mean, I think it went in a backwards term the way they promoted it. I know it's really easy to beat up on the insurance companies, and this reform really seems to be more insurance reform than anything else, but doctors are expensive. I mean, it's incredibly expensive to go to a doctor. And that isn't all the fault of the insurance companies. I mean, medical care in the United States is astronomically high. Doctors make an incredible amount of money. Hospitals are Taj Mahals these days. I haven't seen that addressed. And the other thing I'm wondering about is, why hasn't there been any talk about tort reform? I know that's something that the Republicans were interested in. I think that got crushed immediately. I mean, so try and bring some of those guys on and offer tort reform. Offer the simple competitiveness about being able to purchase insurance across state lines. I mean, the couple of key issues that the Republicans talked about, the Democrats crushed them immediately. But I'm just wondering, why those things weren't put into the bill to try and bring people from the other side over.
Professor Halpin.
Yes, gosh, there was a lot in that. I agree that the framing and the use of the word public option was wrong. I mean, what Europe basically has now, most of Europe has a public system, and then there are private options, increasingly more private options. And that might have been a better way, perhaps, I don't know, to frame it. But it seemed like any sort of move towards single-payer was not even ever on the table. So as far as bringing in some of the Republican ideas, I mean, I think tort reform is a good idea. In California, we have tort reform. You know, the damage awards are limited, I think, to $250,000. And there's no reason all the states can't do that. I don't understand why they don't do it. Honestly, it wouldn't save that much money. I think the estimated total cost of the liability is maybe 3% of total cost. So we certainly could cut that down, and that would contribute, but it's not the major problem that's really driving the system. And I would say, depending upon what state you're in, if you don't have tort reform, you can really fight that battle pretty successfully at the state level. In terms of some of the other ideas, I think selling across state lines, as I mentioned before, is really not a good idea because it's like credit card setting up in Delaware. I mean, you go to the place where there's the least regulation, and so the consumer ends up not being very protected. So I think that I would not support that particular idea. As far as doctors pay,
we have about 15 seconds.
If you are a primary care doctor, you're really not making a lot of money.
Right.
It's the specialists that are making buckets of money, and we need to change that. They need to be making more moderate salaries, and we need to do a better job of paying the primary care doctors because we don't have enough of them. And if everyone gets coverage, I don't know where they're going to go.
Once we know what's going on, I assume we can call you again, please.
Yes.
Thank you. Thanks so much for being with us. Professor, we're done. I'm sorry. We're out of time. Yeah, we're out of time. Bye. Professor Helen Ann Halpin, Professor of Health Policy and Director of the Center for Health and Public Policy Studies at the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing, John Treader for On Air. This is the Ideas Network.